Now, the voyage to the New World and arrival in New England. Now, for all sorts of reasons, and they are pretty endless, really. Family left behind in England, financial difficulties, fear of the unknown. Only a very small percentage of the 300 or so separatists at Leyden decided to make the voyage. They purchased a relatively small ship, a 60-ton ship called the Speedwell, which transported them across the English Channel on the 22nd of July, 1620, to Southampton in Hampshire. They're a much larger boat, the Mayflower, at 180 tons, awaited them. And this is just an artist's rendition here on the left of what the Mayflower looked like. Though there is a replica in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and it's very, very similar to this. It was about 30 meters long and 8 meters wide. So what would that be? About 90, just under 100 feet by 25 feet. It had two decks and three masts. It had been built in Harwich in Essex about a dozen years before and had served as a cargo ship, never having any passengers, so there were no portholes, no comforts whatsoever. It was a cargo ship that had transported wool and cloth and wine to and from France. I think it had made two trips to the Canary Islands, but that's as far as it had ever gone. The Mayflower was captained by someone called Christopher Jones, Master Christopher Jones, who had sailed to Southampton from Rotherhithe in London, carrying, the separatists were already there in Southampton. He carried economic migrants recruited by the merchant adventurers to join the separatists in the New World. Rotherhithe's on the south bank of the River Thames, just east of Tower Bridge, and had a long association with shipbuilders and seafarers. Jones, as well as his first mate, John Clark, and John Moore, one of the ship's four owners, all lived here. Today's Mayflower Pub recalls the spot from where the ship is supposed to have moored before it left London. There are, in fact, records of a pub here called The Ship, dating back to about 1550. But the one current one, the one here, was built in about 1780, first opening as something called the Spread Eagle and Crown, and rebuilt and renamed the Mayflower in the 1950s after suffering extensive damage during World War II. As you could imagine, it's a mecca for American tourists. They have a Mayflower descendants book. But those who can prove a family connection can sign any family connection to any of the pilgrims who made the voyage in 1620. And believe it or not, there are an estimated 10 million of such descendants in America, and possibly as many as 35 million living elsewhere. And these were all descended from 37 people. You do the math. The Mayflower Pub is also the only, this is a fun fact to know and tell, it's the only pub in the UK licensed to sell US postage stamps. The parish church of St. Mary the Virgin, dating from 1715, stands almost next door to the pub. And here it is in the slide on the left. Jones was buried here, though his grave was lost during rebuilding. He was buried in 1622, 2 years after he returned, but since the church was rebuilt in the following century, where his grave actually is remains a mystery. On the tower of the church, there's a blue plaque dedicated to him and the voyage, the Mayflower voyage, unveiled in 2004. And finally, in the churchyard, there's a statue of Jones, shown here on the left in the slide, dedicated in 1995 to mark the 375th anniversary of the voyage. It shows Jones as St. Christopher, the patron saint of travelers, holding a child and looking east towards the old world and home. The child looks to the west and to the new world. Now, on the 15th of August, both ships departed Southampton. This memorial dating from 1913, marks the spot just over that wall there. But not far off Land's End, the extreme southwestern point of England, the Speedwell, the smaller of the two boats, began taking on water, and it was diverted to Dartmouth in Devon for inspection and repairs. That's Dartmouth Harbour there. After about a week, the two ships set sail again. But again, after sailing about 500 kilometers or 300 miles into the Atlantic, it had to return and berth at Plymouth. The Speedwell was abandoned and most of the passengers transferred to the Mayflower. So you can imagine it was very tight, cramped quarters on one boat. They were supposed to be sailing on two. Finally, on the 16th of September, after 6 weeks of going nowhere and already extremely late in the season, the overcrowded Mayflower set sail again from what is now called the Plymouth Steps, shown on the slide here. On board were 102 passengers and about 30 crew. We're not entirely sure the number of the crew, but about 30, we think. The passengers included just 41 Leiden Separatists who called themselves saints. The rest of the people on board, the rest of the passengers, were the economic migrants who were called strangers, also hired hands and servants. Counting all the passengers, there were 50 men, 20 women, and 32 children. So Saints and Strangers is the name of one of the most celebrated books about the early Plymouth colony, Saints and Strangers. The voyage started smoothly, but being very, very late in the season for sailing, it soon hit some very, very strong winds and storms. The sails had to be taken down at one point, at least, and she drifted and glided for days and even managed to crack a main beam. But finally, on the 21st of November, after 66 days of being tossed around at sea, the Mayflower rounded the curve of Cape Cod and sailed into the harbor of what is now Provincetown, where it laid anchor. Miraculously, for such a rough crossing, only one passenger and one crew member had died. And they actually gained a passenger. A baby boy called Oceanus had been born. Interestingly, if you looked around the corner from the shot of the memorial put up in 1910 in Provincetown, Massachusetts, you'd see a very different Provincetown, one of the poshest resort towns on Cape Cod, and very much a gay mecca. Now, the Pilgrims, this is always an interesting story and one that Americans are not completely clear on. I don't know if they teach us this in school, but here goes. The Pilgrims had intended to land in Northern Virginia. And when I say Northern Virginia, I'm talking about practically in today's New York, the borders that went that far north. They were meant to go into Northern Virginia. So where they were was actually, they were only off about a few degrees, but they were still off and they knew they had no right to settle where they now were. So what they did was they decided, both saints and strangers, they decided to draw up a document that would give them some sort of legal standing. It became known as the Mayflower Compact. Now, it's often referred to as the cornerstone of American democracy, and that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but it was a remarkable document for its time, established a rudimentary government for the new colony. It pledged cooperation among the settlers from both sides for the, quote, general good of the colony and organized them into what it called a civil body politic in which issues would be decided by voting. In fact, it was the first written framework of government of what would become the United States. A total of 40 men signed it. They included John Carver, on the right, just here, in the tall hat. Next to him is Edward Winslow. We'll hear a lot more about him, holding the ink horn in his hand. The man signing compact is John Alden, who figures prominently in Longfellow's Courtship of Miles Standish. William Bradford and William Brewster are here as well. Miles Standish is in wearing the helmet. And the girl is said to be a 13-year-old Mary Chilton, who by tradition was the first person ashore at Plymouth. Now that same day, the first of several exploratory parties went out on what they called discoveries. This is the route of where the Mayflower came across the Atlantic. It made landfall just on this wrist of Cape Cod, went down to the southernmost extremity, and then came back up and laid anchor in Provincetown Harbor, just where my laser pointer is here. So after 3 days, 4 days, on Christmas Day, actually, they began one of their so-called discoveries. They found some native settlements and cornfields, and even collected some seed for spring planting. On the third discovery, they were confronted with a group of Indians, which became known as the Huggery of Nauset. Nauset is down here. It became known as the Huggery at Nauset, where arrows were fired and gunshots discharged, but no casualties, fortunately. And this is just a mini aside. There are many terms to use to describe Native Americans nowadays, but Indians, believe it or not, is still the preferred one officially. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which manages things of interest to Native Americans, still prefers to call itself, Native Americans Indians. So I've continued to call them here. They now play a much greater story in the Mayflower and the Plymouth story, which is long, long overdue. Now, it wasn't long before the pilgrims discovered, though, that although there was arable land in the narrow interior of this cape, the forearm, all along here, offered very little beyond sand dunes and a very inadequate water supply. They weighed anchor and sailed due west. You can see the route just here where I'm tracing. Due west and sailed right into Plymouth Harbor. So this is Plymouth in Plymouth Harbor. This is Cape Cod with Provincetown here. And up here is the future Massachusetts colony with its capital at Boston. And this, where my little pointer is, Milton, Massachusetts, where I was born and raised. You can probably tell from my accent.